Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. A new black arts movement has surfaced in the mainstream of American popular culture this summer of 2018. It's not your standard entertainment, and not art for art's sake either. On big screens and tiny ones, in music and poetry, the new black art takes aim, hilariously sometimes, at white supremacy and the color line in capitalism. But this is not race and class revisited. It's attempting to reimagine a society from the bottom up. The late poet Amiri Baraka proclaimed the first black arts movement about 50 years ago and called John Coltrane on the tenor saxophone its highest manifestation. Our guest, Boots Riley, and his summer hit movie for the chattering classes, titled Sorry to Bother You, might be Exhibit A of the new wave.
Hey, young blood, let me give you a tip. You want to make some money here? Use your white boys. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer, this is Langston from Regalview. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Another example would be HBO's new Afro-Surrealist series, Random Acts of Flyness, which offers a satirical cure for the virus of whiteness.
Do you suffer from white thoughts? White thoughts are a symptom of an aggressive disease called acute viral perceptive albinitis, also known as whiteness.
Another strong entry would be Artha Jaffa's 7-minute video montage at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston this summer. It's a dense mix of recognizable African-American scenes, some rapturous, some gruesome. It raises questions like, what is the black visual art that would set us in motion the way black music does? But also, as a woman in Artha Jaffa's film puts it, what would America be like if we loved black people as much as we loved black culture? We get started with Boots Riley, sometime rapper, sometime comic, always a hardcore anti-capitalist, who finally broke through in Hollywood with a script that he'd been shopping around for 15 years. It's on 800 screens this summer. Sorry to Bother You. It's the adventures of a beguiling young hustler in Oakland, California, and his rocket rise in telemarketing after he learns how to use his white voice to become a super caller. In my conversation with Boots Riley, he made no mention of blackness nor of an arts movement. I asked him how he came to call himself a communist when he was 14 years old, growing up in Oakland.
You know, I was 14 and a youth organizer showed up at my door with a van full of other 14-year-olds who were girls and was like, do you want to come to the beach with us? But and I was like, yeah. And he was like, but first we're going to stop at the Watsonville cannery workers strike to support them. You still down? I was like, okay. And got in a van with who I first just saw as 14-year-old girls, but then I saw as 14-year-old people who had this vast understanding or at least knowledge of things going on in the world that I myself, as a 14-year-old, had just let go over my head. And they were talking about things that were on the news as if they understood them. And I was like, wow, like, what's the key to this?
Yeah.
And I realized the key to this, to them being that in touch with it, was the fact that they thought they could do something about it.
Hmm.
And that attracted me. And I got involved from there, got involved in summer projects that were creating an anti-racist farm workers union. So I was doing that. And I think the experiences are what recruited me. I didn't start reading stuff. You know, I didn't actually... I think my father's big critique of me, I joined a radical organization, Progressive Labor Party, when I was 15.
Hmm.
And his big critique was, you know, that he went and said to those organizers, like, he doesn't even read anything, you know, whatever. And I didn't start really reading the theory until afterward, after I was involved in stuff, because I wouldn't have connected to it as much. I read the same way you do read an IKEA manual while you have all the stuff laid there on the floor. Try to read an IKEA try to read an IKEA instruction booklet without the stuff while you're just sitting at a bar or something. You don't care. But you got all that stuff laid out for you. You read it differently. Presto, read the Communist Manifesto. Gorillas in the midst of
Guevara and Manesto. So what a brother with an act out now. So what did the teenager distill as the message? And what would it be today? I'm thinking actually of a moment in one of your rap videos where your character says, I was doomed since my date of birth to be the wretched of the earth. I consumed, knew that I was doomed since my date of birth to be the wretched of the earth. Never had a dream that was American. How did that crystallize in your young head? And what does it mean today for action?
I think, for instance, when we were doing Occupy Oakland, one of the reasons why it was one of the largest things is we had something tangible we were asking people to do, which was a general strike. We're going to shut this thing down. We're shutting that down. There's an idea that it was connected to occupations happening in every city and town in the United States. People that had never gotten involved in something before got involved because it's all about people wanting to be engaged and wanting their life to feel like it's effective, you know, in changing the world, and therefore it means something. So that's what I was going for, and that's similar to what's happening right now.
Right. You're striking a lot of the themes that are woven into that movie, too. We'll come back. I want to come back to strikes, which are absolutely central in the movie, but I'm also interested in the young you. You were also an aspiring musician and also, dare I say, a humorist.
Mr. Rockefeller, let me in on the gossip. I heard you and Mr. Getty are getting into rap music or something.
Yes, we have this thing we do with our voices. Let me see if I can do my voice like those rappers. Here we go.
Here we go.
Well, if you're blind as Helen Keller, you could see I'm David Rockefeller. So much cash up in my bedroom.
Then you were a telemarketer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did this all come together in this giant vision of you in the workplace and what needed to be done, what the workers were waiting for?
So I quit doing music after our second album. I was 24 and had a midlife crisis. And I felt like I had just been an artist for my whole adult life. And obviously, the idols that I had were folks that were really involved in world-changing movements when they were 19, 20, you know. Che Guevara, Fred Hampton, folks like that. And I was like, what am I? I'm wasting my life, you know, just making statements. So I quit. And me and some friends created an organization called the Young Comrades. And in order to fund myself being able to do that, I eventually had to get a job. And that was doing telemarketing because I was good at it. And I could work one day, sometimes just every few days, sometimes one day a week or one day every 2 weeks and make enough so that I could just be organizing after that. You know, how that comes together with this is that I kept making, from that point on, I more accepted myself as an artist. And I kept making music, but understanding that it has to be tied in with campaigns or things that are going on the ground. It can't just be me making philosophical ponderings in cute ways.
Yeah. People watch this movie, I think, and wonder, what should I be doing? These people are striking. They're denouncing the bosses of their BS jobs, as David Graeber calls them. They're acting. They're plotting, planning. What should we be doing coming out of this movie besides laughing and recounting the best scenes?
We need a new labor movement, one that organizes the rest of the 93% of the working class that is not in unions, and a labor movement that does not follow the laws. Right now, even before these Janus rulings, there have been laws in place since the late 40s, since 1948, one called the Taft-Hartley Law, which makes solidarity strikes illegal. And the reason that a solidarity strike is like, let's say you're organizing a union at Burger King and that's Burger King on Fifth Street or whatever. But the other Burger Kings want to strike in solidarity to force the hand of the owners. That's illegal. And the reason it's illegal is because it works. And the reason for unions not working as well is because they follow those laws. Mm. So we need labor movement, but that labor movement needs to have a vision of actually even changing the economic system we're in eventually. It needs to be led by radicals, because those are the only ones where what we're doing is feeding into this movement for changing the world. This is the thing, is we know the way capitalism works. The main leverage point of capitalism is not at the place where you buy. It's not at the point of purchase. It's at the point where your labor creates wealth. And there's been a big emphasis on boycotts in the last 50, 60 years. They don't really work. They don't. Overall, they don't. We're not able to figure out who's doing it. We're not able to really even organize and work with each other. And it's been put out there as a answer to strikes. We need to organize. Radicals need to not only be involved in demonstrations that happen after work and on Saturdays or whatever. In the 20s and 30s, demonstrations were demonstrations of here's 10,000 people that can shut down your industry. That's where we need to get to.
Who knows, Bruce Riley, we may be getting there. I mean, tech workers are organizing. Google workers say they won't work for ICE. West Virginia teachers want an important strike.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
I mean, in the movie, the telemarketers finally rise up and roar, phones down. And
spoiler.
What would it take in our world?
You know, it's all, as we said, it's already happening. If we look at the signs of where people are at, even before, you know, like the West Virginia teacher strike and all of these things you brought up, you can also look to how many people, fast food workers, were wanting to organize a few years ago. Walmart workers went on strike and were met by militia. The point is that people are ready for things that even those on the left have kind of watered down what we're going for based on us believing the media. And a lot of the mainstream media, the whole point is to make you feel like you're the most radical person in the room. And it's not necessarily true.
That was Boots Riley, writer and director of Sorry to Bother You. Coming up, a critic in the moment of the moment, Doreen San Felice of The New Yorker. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. With a new generation of black artists to the fore comes a new generation of critics. Doreen San Felice is 26 years old, Brooklyn-born, of Haitian parents. She grew up bookish in the Canarsie section without any ambition, she says, to be a professional writer. And then she got hot in the African-American and cultural blogosphere. And now she's writing incisive commentary for The New Yorker magazine on such matters as Beyoncé's Lemonade and Donald Glover's This Is America. I asked her this week, what is going on?
We're right to identify this moment as being one of a flourishing of black media. And by black media, we mean music, we mean fashion, we mean film. And I think that there is an intertextuality that I would say characterizes some of the bigger projects that have come out in the mainstream within the past 10, 20 years. I would say this is the fruits of a generation. What really excites people, at the same time that maybe it makes them a little bit nervous, is this moment is defined by a cultural control. So many of the documents that we're talking about are actually owned or produced by the artists. It reflects the increasing power of the black artist as a cultural negotiator, as someone who is starting to have, as Solange would say in her album, a seat at the table. But that seat is incredibly fraught. You know, many times that seat is actually, it's just a person being invited to be a figurehead, invited to be insurance for the company to say that they are, you know, employing Black creators. And also sometimes that person comes from a specific Black background, whether that might be because of class or because of politics. And therefore, when they are made a spokesperson or kind of like the megaphone for this entire blob that we always call the Black community, you end up with scenarios where the viewers who are supposed to want to be represented by every kind of Black media they consume decidedly feel not represented by it. And I think that it creates this tension. One thing that seems to be lost in a lot of our discussion of this great Black art that we're just swimming in is, well, what is it saying about the classes of Black people in America? What is it saying about the Black bourgeoisie? Is it even daring to interrogate the Black bourgeoisie because that is the class that is producing it? I mean, it's in my nature to think about what are the machines that have brought me this film that I'm looking at? Who invested in this album? Who directed this photo shoot? It's in my nature to interrogate all of that. And I hope that we as viewers will not feel so desperate that we have to not be caring about the way that we think about the work just because we're so desperate to have it in the first place.
Doreen, go back to the scope of this thing and the variety of it. It's music, it's video, it's also politics, it's also Black consciousness across the board.
Right.
For me, it surfaced in a spectacular way, obviously, in Black Panther, billion-dollar movie.
Right.
Just the credits alone testify to the depth and range of talents that put that thing together. Hairdressers, sound designers, actors, musicians. Speak of the particular things we want to talk about, including Boots Riley's movie, Sorry to Bother You, but also Lemonade, which you've written about beautifully. Also, Random Acts of Flyness on HBO.
Yes.
Where do you begin your inventory of what's going on?
Starting with Lemonade seems to be a very critical moment. It does begin, this deluge, but also because it marks a cleaving moment in the artist's career, that artist being Beyoncé. With her declarations of being a feminist, with her self-titled album, which came out in the early 2010s, people started to consider that her work had a political valence.
Hmm.
When I would argue all of the work that she did in Destiny's Child that was rooted in like a Black Southern swagger, that also had a political valence, but maybe it wasn't as legible to the white consumer.
Hmm.
But plastering feminists in hot pink on a stage, that does become increasingly readable. And I think with Lemonade, what happened was that so many of these images are images that we'd seen through Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust, and those images had been inspired by the surrealness of Toni Morrison's universes. What we saw was that Beyoncé was in dialogue with other creators. And I think what defines many of these films that have become tent poles of, you know, let's call this for now the resurgence of a Black arts movement, they seem to be in dialogue with their predecessors. The critical conversation is becoming more robust in that we're learning not to put every burden of meaning and every burden of representation on a single creator. It's amazing to me, especially, you know, just considering like 2 years ago, Moonlight was a film that had to be everything, right? It had to be the film for the Black viewer, it had to be the film for the gay viewer, whereas this year, 2018, we can talk about at least three films that have been made by directors who are all interrogating a particular pocket of the Black American experience.
Name them.
So obviously Black Panther comes in as the industry steamroller. It opened this year, I think, with conversations around that film, people started to activate the sense of the Black diaspora. What is so interesting about Black Panther is that many of these creators and many of these actors are not simply Black Americans. Many of them have been brought onto the project by Ryan Coogler specifically because they are not American. Mm. And they are able to endow this fantasy world of Wakanda with a sense of personality, with a sense of history, with a sense of culture that they borrow from their origins, right? You have Black people from Britain, you have Lupita Nyong'o, who was actually born in Mexico. And so there was a real sense of, you know, the Black American experience cannot be made the singular global Black experience. And I think that Black Panther, ironically a Marvel film, was able to get people to sort of think more broadly. Additionally, we have Sorry to Bother You, which is a socialist film. It's a film that's interrogating class. It's also a film that's set in Oakland, which it has in common with Black Panther.
The new center of the universe.
It's amazing how many stories are being located in that space. And when we think about what is actually happening there in real time, when we think about gentrification, we think about the encroachment of Silicon Valley, these films seem to be just on the peripheral of true life, even though, you know, one is a fantasy and the other one is a satire. They seem to be indexing stressors that Black Americans who are, you know, seeing these movies in their communities are experiencing. And so they have that moment of identification, you know, at the end of Black Panther, when T'Challa comes and builds a community center in Oakland. What that is, of course, talking about is the erosion of those services happening in that space.
Okay. And number three?
Number three, of course, would be Black Klansman, which is a true story based on a memoir. This man, Stallworth, he became the first Black police officer in Colorado Springs, Colorado in the 1970s. And he wrote this memoir about his incredible feat of infiltrating the KKK. The film ends with some footage of the Charlottesville rally from 2017. So, you know, whatever you think of Spike Lee's decision to include that real life footage, his film, with or without it, would have been in direct dialogue with what is happening in society. You know, it comes out literally on the anniversary of the Charlottesville chaos.
Doreen, the range of, what do we call them, genres or styles, is amazing. Afrofuturism in Black Panther, Afro-surrealism, absurdism, as you're saying, but also realism in Spike Lee's film. Going back to Sorry to Bother You, it is satire about Silicon Valley, among other things, but it's also a kind of call to organize.
Mm-hmm.
Phones down, let's get organized. Do we call this a revolution? Is it satire? Is it mockery?
Right.
The context includes, as you say, Charlottesville, but also Trump himself, also Black Lives Matter,
right.
Also a kind of stalled politics of the center-left, shall we say, of the Democratic Party, the pressure of white identity politics.
It does absolutely seem like these movies are kind of hoovering every single signal and sign of our moment. But I actually, in my consumption, both as a casual viewer and also in my slightly more formal role as a critic, do feel resistant to calling this a revolution or perhaps even using words like radical. I think in the case of Sorry to Bother You, it seems appropriate given Riley's explicit history as a labor organizer, his very clearly stated politics. But, you know, in another film like Black Klansman, it becomes a bit muddled what the film is telling us to think about, for instance, the white moderate, or what the film is telling us to think about the police force in a moment where states are deciding to pass Blue Lives Matter laws. So I think for me, it's important to recognize that these films that we've become so transfixed by, the television, the music, it's big business too. We're nearing what people are terming the 50th anniversary of hip hop's birth, you know, from basements in the Bronx to all of a sudden it is a global lingua franca. And in the aging, there has been some concessions that have been made. Whenever we decide to overload onto our cultural texts the power to necessarily incite movements, I think what happens is that we belie the artist's intent. Some artists are actually primarily concerned with telling stories. And of course, as audiences, we can run with those stories and we can make our conclusions. But I think it's extremely important, especially in a moment where I would say the Trumpian way of looking at things has been about overloading every single cultural phenomenon with political power, I think it's important to remember to let our art be art and to engage in it in a way that is faithful to what the text is actually saying.
Doreen St. Felice at The New Yorker, I want to ask, what does it tell us that white folk, large portions of them, seem to love the whole sensibility?
That is definitely an indication of something, right? I think for one thing, it's a reminder that we are dealing in entertainment. I hardly believe that a radical text will come from a big budget Hollywood studio, right? There is an appeasement or maybe even some strange, I would say, arousal that white viewers experience looking at the kind of disembodied stereotype or caricature of themselves. And that's something that Black Klansmen does, right?
Speak of the white audience, too, for these films. We've wondered, do white viewers laughing along with Random Acts of Blindness, for example, do they suppose they're exempting themselves from the critique by their laugh?
It's an interesting question. Of course, we're becoming anthropologists of white people in the Trumpian era. We're discovering all of their slight differences, their cultural connections, where they differ from each other. And so obviously there is a category of white person who identifies as anti-racist, who does the work of being anti-racist, who might look at lampoons of the stereotype and rejoice in it because they don't recognize themselves in it. But I think that many of these films are actually interested in making that line a bit murkier. The white liberal or the white moderate is a very potent type that animates a lot of race-based self-referential comedy. This is something that I was thinking about after I'd seen Black Klansmen. These films are most powerful when they're not simply relying on making whiteness unrelatable. I think that they are delving into some of the more uncomfortable or queasy instincts that the white viewer has when they start to engage with the mirror effect. When you start to see a character, even, you know, John Hamm in Random Acts of Blindness, obviously he's playing a character, but in that skit, he is, I would say, invoking the kind of like sensible white person who has receded in terms of who we think is worth talking to because Trump has created a cultural arena where the white person that we tend to think of right now is literally a neo-Nazi.
Well, it's just, I know, you know, we sort of talked about the spectrum of ethnic identity sort of subsumed in whiteness. And, you know, I'm not exactly, you know, white. I'm more of a Irish.
John, I empathize. I understand. I hear you.
Good. Because I don't want to.
But you aren't here because of your relative cultural proximity to the whites. You are here because the people that call themselves white, those victims, for whatever reason, they trust you and that beautiful beige face of yours, drunk with whiteness, stumbling in their stupor.
I think that Random Acts of Blindness is one example of a show that I actually could never have imagined would have been invited to HBO, even as HBO is known for sort of cutting the edge or whatever. And so these texts are actually doing, as much as they might be involved in quote-unquote representing blackness, I think they are doing an anthropology, an excavation, an archaeology of whiteness too.
You're speaking of a black arts movement, complicated, diverse, all kinds of things going on, but everybody seems to see it as an extension of the black arts movement that Amiri Baraka and others, I think especially John Coltrane, defined in the 70s, maybe, 60s, right, 70s, right. 80s, and ever after. This is the way he remembered what he was thinking and maybe going through back then.
You have to remember the time it was, you know, just getting ready to the 60s to burst. I always thought that Giant Steps like was, you know, opening up of that.
When Amiri Baraka spoke to me a decade ago, the force of John Coltrane was vivid in his voice. Train was our flag, he had written. We could feel what he was doing. We heard our own search and travail in the opening of Giant Steps. So this Black Arts Movement time in 2018 is an extension, a continuation of something. What links do you emphasize?
It's so interesting that you bring this up. A few months ago, I was doing research on Gwendolyn Brooks, who was obviously someone who interfaced with Amiri Baraka, I think actually when he was still Leroy Jones. She was very active in Chicago and the Bronzeville neighborhood throughout her entire life. And she kind of sat down with a few special grade schoolers. I think this was in the 80s. And one of these grade schoolers was Kanye West. And Kanye West happened to deliver, at that point, it had just been a poem, but when he delivered it to her, he made it a rap. And I think it's an important reminder of how close the history is. We're not talking about grand waves of time. So when we compare, I think, what is happening in the 2010s with what is happening in the 60s and 70s, of course, I wasn't around at that time, but my perception is that Black Lives Matter as being the political energy of our time is maybe not as represented as it could possibly be in the art itself. We don't have a Black Lives Matter movie necessarily. We have films that are pointing to its influence, that are pointing to the information machine that is social media, that Black Lives Matter was so important in terms of, I would say, inventing after the Arab Spring. We're still in the contemporaneous moment. It's hard to say that we have artists who are actually producing to or producing about this political movement that is happening at the same time. But, you know, that's all just to say that maybe in 5 years or something like that, we'll have a very different scene in terms of what television or film will be made.
Doreen Sanfelice writes for The New Yorker magazine on paper and online. Coming up, the muse of the movement, though he would deny it, poet and theorist Fred Moten. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest, Fred Moten, would recoil from the label of great guru or master teacher of a Black arts movement just because he doesn't like the idea of individual greatness as such, or mastery, or even newness. And still, Fred Moten is the poet, the critical theorist, and voice that many others cite as their guide to what's suddenly emerging. Now, in his mid-50s, Fred Moten traces his taste for surrealism to growing up in the 1960s and 70s among Arkansas country people who'd been transplanted to Las Vegas. He wrote his undergraduate thesis at Harvard on Harold Bloom, the literary lion we love. The thread through Fred Moten's writing is something else. It's his idea that collectives produce art, not stars. And it's the false worship of individuals, he says, that endangers the whole planet.
I tend to think of the work that I'm most interested in now is an extension of that moment in the Black arts movement, or another way to put it is just an extension of the aesthetic element, so to speak, of the Black radical tradition, as, you know, as Cedric Robinson uses that phrase. So my thinking is usually more like a long arc kind of thing is what I tend to gravitate towards. Yes. than the belief in the uniqueness of this or that moment.
We're listening, but I love your thought, though, that we're talking about a long arc, the continuities that end up much more important than the breaks, the changes, the sudden stardoms or histories or nicknames for bebop or hip-hop or whatever. And you're our authority on the long, radical Black aesthetic tradition. You look out on that long landscape, who do you see? Who do you remember? Who do you feel?
I mean, there are certainly figures in the tradition whom I love, you know, and whose work I gravitate towards. But the whole thing is, I just feel like the tradition is sort of, you know, it includes and it envelops and it embraces these individual figures. And then it also puts these individual figures out and it exudes them. There's certain folks I come back to, so, you know, Zora Neale Hurston and Miles Davis and Cecil Taylor and Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yes.
Maybe there's never been such a flowering of really great and interesting individual black artists in the way that there is today. But I don't know if that's particularly good for the tradition or for black art. It's an interesting question. I think there's a distinction to be made between black art and black artists. And maybe the thing I love most about black art is how much pressure it puts on the very idea of the individual artist. And I think it tends to undermine that pressure. So for instance, we can talk all day about John Coltrane or Miles Davis, but when we talk about Miles Davis, we know who we're really talking about mm-hmm. is Miles Davis and Paul Chambers and Philly Joe Jones and, you know, John Coltrane yes. and Cannonball Adderley. And when we're talking about John Coltrane, we know that who we're really talking about is McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones and Jimmy Garrison and Coltrane. So it's, these individual names signify an ensemble of aesthetic work and insurgency that the valorization and the lionization of the individual name tends to militate against the recognition of how deep the actual art is, you see. So
it doesn't have to undermine it, but I know exactly what you're talking about. I say the reason they called this the American Century was two things. We got into World War II late and came out whole, and the Basie Band. What he did with 4/4 Time, I'd say the same about Duke. I'd say the same about Bill Russell in another way. There's a real artist at work in our lives that transformed the game of basketball. I would think of Roy Haynes, the drummer, many, many others. I think the names are important, if only to illustrate what's under it all.
Well, the reason they call it the American Century is because the United States killed tremendous amounts of people in this century.
That's true, too.
And made it seem like they were doing it for the people who they killed. That it did so, covered under a certain sense by this tremendous and beautiful insurgency of black art, is a complicated matter that we all have to work through and think about. I don't want to be part of anything called an American Century. And my sense of it is that I would hope that Basie would say the same thing and, you know, Bill Russell would say the same thing.
I think Bill Russell would, for sure.
One way to think about the American Century is that it attempts to obliterate all kinds of amazing forms of communal social life in the name of the logic and the political economy of the individual name. So if there would be anything like an Afro-American century that I would want to claim or to valorize, it would be to resist that logic. Mm. Like I said, it's not that I don't love and admire and respect Bill Russell. It's just that when we talk about Bill Russell, we know that we're also talking about Casey Jones and Sam Jones and Satch Sanders and John Havlicek and Red Auerbach, for that matter. So the individual name is just a sign for a whole bunch of names and a whole bunch of people who often go nameless.
Fred Moten, would you start back in your own rural Arkansas boyhood, and when you started picking up on these understandings?
I probably did kind of have a rural Arkansas boyhood. It's just that it was lived in Las Vegas, Nevada. You know, there's a great essay by Toni Morrison called City Limits, Village Values, and I think it describes in many ways how I grew up, which was in a small village in Arkansas that had been transplanted to Las Vegas, Nevada. And part of what that meant was I grew up around a whole bunch of really smart and interesting people who had a lot of brilliant things to say about art and social life. And I was lucky enough to be around that and to be able to listen to them.
You're associated with a kind of identification of surrealism in everyday black life. Did that dawn on you in your Arkansas, Vegas upbringing?
I can look back on things that I saw growing up that were definitely weird and surreal and beautiful in that way. The way people talked and walked and the clothes people would wear, different scenes and different moments that I remember growing up that were certainly out of the ordinary. My mom, she was just always a very friendly, outgoing person, and kids always loved her. I was the only child. I think she always was trying to gather a whole bunch of other kids around me. She was heavy set. She decided she wanted to lose some weight, and she was going to start taking walks through the neighborhood. All the kids would go with her, and we would walk, and we lived on a kind of hill. So I remember one time we were walking back up the hill towards our house, and my mom was getting tired. And she said, told somebody, we were all 10 or 11 years old. She told somebody, push me, give me a push. And by the end of it, there are like 12 kids pushing her up the street. That's the one in my mind that stands out today. But there's so many more. Some people listening will know exactly what I'm talking about. I just grew up in a black community, a working class black community, in which there were just all kinds of interesting, beautiful people. And we lived under a definite kind of duress. And I think kids knew that. We knew that relatively early on in our lives. But it didn't undermine our capacity to enjoy one another.
Mm. Your friend and mine, Robin Kelly, says that for him, your breakthrough discovery and doctrine in a certain way was that there is nothing wrong with black people.
Well, I don't think it was my discovery, but I certainly believe that that's the case.
Spell that out, what it means in a white-dominated, maybe in many places white supremacist society and culture.
Obviously, the structure of anti-blackness in American life has very much been predicated on the notion that there is something wrong or less or non-standard in some fundamental way that characterizes black people, and not just black people, but even more importantly, black social life. And it's a sense of deficiency, of lesserness, that has not only been assumed and been raised to the level of a philosophical and a scientific principle, but then it has also been enforced as a matter of law. Whether black people were inherently insufficient or not, the question wasn't just left to chance by the power structure of this country and most of the world, but in order to ensure that insufficiency, legal and juridical means were liberally, so to speak, deployed in order to make that happen, whether it took the form of theft and torture in formal slavery or brutal forms of incarceration that persist now in what we might call informal slavery. So they were going to make sure we were insufficient, whether we were or not. And somehow, miraculously, against every possible odds, we refused both the imposition of this idea that we were insufficient, and we also resisted the imposition of a set of social facts that were supposed to make us insufficient. It's one of the great miracles of the world.
Fred Moten, come back to the aesthetic tradition, which emerges again in a very big way this year, not out of nowhere, but out of fundamental work that you've been doing for 20 plus years in publishing. Where are we in our reckoning of these issues?
Well, what I mentioned before about this sort of intense flowering, so to speak, of black artists, and my admiration of these artists doesn't quite eclipse the sense I have that maybe it's still not such a great time for black art. There's something like what one might call a kind of class struggle in black aesthetic and intellectual life right now.
Describe it.
Well, you've got an emerging, maybe second, even third generation black bourgeoisie, which is producing a very interesting and populous cohort of artists, and who at the same time are being asked to talk about and to illuminate modes of experience that we often associate with black working class life. And I think there's a gap or a struggle, a kind of conflict there. And it's a conflict that has to be addressed and worked through rather than simply overlooked. The capacity for black working class social life and the particular difficulties and modes of conflict and duress that is lived in that space, it's unclear to me that it can simply be spoken for and spoken of in unproblematic ways, even by black folks who haven't necessarily lived that life. That's one possible problem. there are some others. But it doesn't mean that the art that is being produced, which attempts to speak to that life, is bad mm-hmm. or not accomplished. It's often quite good and very accomplished. But it also reveals a rupture and reveals a set of problems and constraints at the level of the relationship between Black life and Black art that have to be addressed and that can't simply be addressed by some general celebration that we all might have, that there are lots and lots of new Black curators in fancy white museums, or that there are more and more shows by great Black artists, you know, in those same museums, or that we have important and interesting Black film directors now. All those things are great. They're not bad things. But the simple, unquestioned belief that this constitutes a victory or even an advance for Black social life in general and for Black working class life in particular, that's a problematic assumption. I don't see any reason, any justification for making it, you see.
No, but spell that out. Spell the, even in your own head, the struggle to tell it all, to embrace your whole experience.
I don't think about it in terms of this or that individual trying to embrace or to relate or to tell or to illuminate his or her own personal experience. I think that Black life, Black social life, and at its best, Black art is a radical critique of the very idea of private personal experience. And I remember reading Amiri Baraka's liner notes to an album called The New Black Music.
Yes.
And the last line of his liner notes was, "The new black music is this, find the self, then kill it." That formulation meant everything to me. He didn't say find the self, then express it, right? Or find the self, then valorize it. Find the self, then give care to it. He said find the self, then kill it.
Immediately, I think of Ralph Waldo Emerson, Self-Reliance. He's credited and blamed for a tremendous cultivation of the self. You know, trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. It's all about mm-hmm. self, in a way. It's not full of self, necessarily. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, what example do you find in the great collective expressions of Black music? The bands, maybe above all, but any number of ensembles, including Coltrane's and the Stars that you mentioned, all of them important. What does that tell you? Did Coltrane get over self? As I suspect he did.
Well, one of my favorite late albums by him is called Selflessness. I don't know if he got over it, but it seems pretty clear to me that he was trying to get past it, trying to get through it.
Fred, signposts going forward. What's coming? And do you see a tipping point in the kind of larger consciousness of this country?
I remember listening again to my teacher and mentor, Cedric Robinson. He was a Black Marxist in terms of his recognition and his sense that the contradictions of contemporary capitalism render the infinite extension of what constitutes now normative political economic life impossible. The best way to put it is, we can't go on like this. The world can't go on like this. And the question is, are we gonna listen to folks who already have some understanding of the fact that there are other ways to live on Earth? And my belief in the importance of the Black radical tradition is that in that tradition, we have knowledge that there are other ways to live on the earth. And that knowledge is to be valorized and protected and at the same time extended and criticized with love and with an intensity that matches the duress that we all live under now. If we want to protect the earth's capacity to sustain us, then we got to learn to live differently and better and not viciously. Not violently, okay? Recognizing that anti-Blackness is misogynistic, homophobic, anti-indigenous. There are other names we could use to describe it too. Okay, but that's the task. That's the project, in my not so humble opinion.
Thank you, Fred Moten. Thank you, Doreen Saint-Felice. And thank you, Boots Riley. And thanks especially for the voice, the soul of the incomparable Aretha Franklin, rocking now and forever in the bosom of Abraham. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.